from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Edward Snowden was just 29 when he pulled off the biggest leak in history, exposing the full scope and reach of NSA surveillance. A new book chronicles the full story of the leak and the man behind it, from Snowden's early days trading computer tips as an anonymous whiz kid on tech websites to Edward Snowden, now a hugely controversial man in limbo. This hour on Point, understanding Edward Snowden. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see Snowden now? How do you understand his motivation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from London is Luke Harding, correspondent at The Guardian, the British newspaper that first published Snowden's leaked revelations. Harding was part of the team that saw the first files coming in from Snowden. He's a former Moscow bureau chief for The Guardian. His new book is The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. Luke Harding, welcome to On Point.
Tom, thank you very much for having me.
So how should we this is a good read, and I enjoyed it. I learned from it. But how should we understand exactly your role here, Luke? After all, you work for the organization that was fully party to the revelations that some are celebrating and others are calling treasonous. So are you here to build up, back up, buck up Edward Snowden? What's your motivation, Luke, in writing the biography?
Well, my motivation was to tell the story, and what an incredible story it is. You sketched that in your introduction, and certainly The Guardian has been in on this story from the very beginning. We published the first NSA story on the 5th of June, which I'm sure you remember, about the fact the NSA was hoovering up all of this telephone data from everybody, from Verizon, and ran a sort of series of scoops after that over the past 8 months. So we've been involved. I mean, I wrote this book, I think, for everybody, for people who've been following the story passionately, and also for people who are not sure whether he's a traitor or a whistleblower or something in between, to tell the story in a dramatic way, which did justice to him and also did justice to the journalists who were working on this story in very difficult circumstances.
But back up for a second, Luke. We want to hear all that, but The Guardian was in bed with him from the beginning on this, and not everybody's happy about what's been put out there. Others are very happy about it. But are you here to somehow construct an image of Edward Snowden that will make him more palatable to the world? Are you working as an objective journalist? How should a reader understand your role here? After all, you're still working for The Guardian, which is still in the thick of this.
Well, Edward Snowden was our source. He came to us. He came to my colleague Glenn Greenwald with this material, and we evaluated it and published some of it. But my job wasn't to make him more or less beautiful. It was to tell this story, some of which is a little odd, all of which is kind of compelling, and which leads with Snowden ending up in Moscow. So there was no agenda as such. It's kind of almost like the first draft of history. That's what I've tried to do, and I'm sure that other people will also write books on Edward Snowden. We felt it was an important exercise.
I want to look back to the origins of Edward Snowden, his early years. They're surely important, given that he leaked at such a massive scale, blew the whistle, however you want to describe it, at such a young age. But bring us up to date first, if you can, Luke. Where is Edward Snowden now? What are his circumstances now?
Well, that's an extremely delicate question, which really goes to the heart of the debate as to who he is, whether he's a traitor or a whistleblower. My own view is that he's not a traitor. I think he's absolutely an idealist, someone who believes fervently in the Constitution. And one of the things I try and do in chapter two of my book is kind of look at his intellectual development as someone who's very much a conservative, a libertarian, a person of the right, and a believer in the state, who becomes progressively disillusioned while working for the CIA, initially in Geneva in Switzerland, and then subsequently in Japan. And by the time he arrives at Hawaii, is really plotting to carry out this extraordinary leak. I mean, as for his circumstances now, I think it's complicated. I think on the one hand, he says, and I believe him, that he hasn't shared any of this material with the Russians. But on the other hand, speaking as someone who spent 4 years in Moscow and who reported on that story, he's stuck in a pretty dark, pretty gloomy authoritarian state, which is no friend of the United States.
I want to get to philosophically, but I don't really mean where is he philosophically. I mean, where is he physically? What are his physical circumstances? Do you believe he's voluntarily in Russia now? Does he want to get out? What kind of freedom does he have or not have? What's known, Luke?
Well, we don't know precisely where he is. That's very secret, and it's not something that he's discussed. He spent a month in Moscow airport after arriving from Hong Kong and was whisked away to some kind of safe house. Now, I've spoken to journalist contacts of mine, to Russians who speculate that he's somewhere near Moscow, that he's possibly in a kind of, you know, on his own, possibly in a kind of government-controlled flat. But we simply don't know. There's no reliable data. But I think what we do know is that Snowden got stuck there, that Russia was never his first choice, that he was trying to get to Latin America. His real preference was Iceland. He wanted to go to Iceland because he liked its media freedoms. But for the moment, he's in Moscow or near Moscow. I think it's fair to say that he is no traitor, but I don't think it's fair to say that the Russian government clearly has an interest in him.
What about the data that he took from the NSA? Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, said that if you took all the documents that Edward Snowden stole, leaked, and stacked them up, that stack would be 3 miles high. We're talking a million and a half documents. He left Hawaii with 4 laptops. What's known about where all that information is now? You have some of it at The Guardian, right? Who else? And what about Edward himself?
Well, again, I'll tell you what's known. We did have some material in London. We don't have it anymore because the British government forced us to smash our own laptops up. We are partnering with the New York Times. So some of this material is in New York. Some of it is with Glenn Greenwald, formerly of The Guardian in Rio. And I think it's no secret that some of it's in Germany with Laura Poitras. So
this is the filmmaker who was also in Hong Kong to meet Edward Snowden with Greenwald when he came out.
Three people who met him. There was Glenn, Laura, and my colleague Ewan McCaskill. And some of this is with Barton Gellman, the national security correspondent for The Washington Post. So Edward Snowden has a lot of media partners. This stuff is very dispersed.
Does he still have it on his person or with him? Does he have the laptops or the data that was on them with him in Russia?
Well, he has said very vociferously that he didn't pitch up in Russia with this stuff, and that even under torture, he would be unable to kind of reveal it. That basically he made the dump in Hong Kong, shared this material with journalists, and essentially turned it over and said, exercise your editorial judgment and publish what you think is in the public interest to get this debate on surveillance going. So he is very clear he hasn't got it. Various security people say it may have leaked, but there's been nothing tangible to confirm that.
So his only leverage in this kind of, I guess you'd describe it as a conversation with the U.S. authorities, the Department of Justice, not direct at all, but long distance, his leverage is the information that's still out there, I guess, that they don't want to be further exposed, though it continues to be exposed. Does that mean that The Guardian and The Times and The Post are, in effect, prepared to negotiate on his behalf? If you let Edward go to Brazil, we'll stop publishing this? Or is that not on the table?
No, I mean, Tom, I think that's a somewhat sort of far-fetched scenario. I mean, we're not sort of, you know, negotiators. We're journalists, and we look at this stuff not in a kind of frivolous or irresponsible way, but we publish the information which I think has sort of started this tremendous debate in the U.S., but also globally.
I don't think anybody would think of it as frivolous, but there was recently the sense that the Department of Justice might be open to cutting a deal. I mean, they said as much with Snowden, and the implication that many took from that was that, you know, if he would put a cork in the bottle, maybe some deal could be made. You would have to be party to that deal, would you not, in the other newspapers?
Yeah, I think it would be extremely tricky because there are all sorts of journalists all over the world who are working on this material. So it wouldn't just have to be with one newspaper; it would have to be with many. And really, I think that the bottle is floated away. I don't think you can recork this particular bottle. But what I can say is that what we have published from Snowden's files is very small. It's it's a tiny percentage. And it's only those documents in which I think there's a legitimate public interest. I mean, we've published nothing operational and have tried to engage with the White House and the relevant agencies before publication. That's been our strategy all along.
So he has no leverage to say, I'll stop this if you cut me some kind of deal. Can you imagine him ending up anywhere but in exile or prison?
Well, I don't want to speak for him because he can speak for himself. But I think the reality of the situation is, unless there is some kind of deal, from where I sit, that looks less rather than more likely. I think he will be stuck in Moscow I conclude my book for saying kind of, you know, months, years, decades, but for a long time. Germany, for example, there's been absolute uproar in Germany over the fact we now know that the NSA for a very long time was spying on Angela Merkel. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't want to give him asylum either. And so because transatlantic relations are too important. I can't envisage a scenario in the near future in which he can move unless there's some kind of game changing moment in the US.
From what you know of him, and you know a lot, we'll come to it. Do you think he's okay with that? This was important enough to Edward Snowden that he was willing to pay that kind of price?
I think that's right. My colleague Ewan McCaskill, who met him, said that Snowden told him he was prepared to sacrifice everything for this, his entire life. He felt this debate was so important that, and to be honest, I never think he thought he would get as far as he did.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Edward Snowden, the man who laid bare the scale of NSA surveillance globally and in the United States. A new biography lays out his life and motivations. Its author, Luke Harding, joins us from London. He's a correspondent at The Guardian. The new book is The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Luke Harding in London, give it to us in a nutshell, the young man who became this mega leaker. What did you find in his youth, his background, that may be most relevant to us understanding his actions?
Well, I found that he traveled quite a long way. If you look at his kind of early logs, he started essentially posting on this technology forum at the age of 18. He was very technologically savvy, really a genius with computers, but someone who had flunked out of high school. But his views, if you like, were pretty Republican, pretty patriotic, pretty right wing, and
eventually kind of a Ron Paul guy, you say?
Yeah, he donated to Ron Paul's campaign. He was not a fan of Hillary when Hillary was facing off against Obama. He liked John McCain a little bit, but he was someone firmly in this kind of very American, very libertarian tradition. And I think most intriguingly, in one sort of chat conversation in 2009, he really let rip at the New York Times for leaking, as he regarded it, classified information on the Middle East, on Iran, and complained anonymously, but kind of bitterly. And I think...
So you don't put that in a newspaper, he wrote in that exchange.
You don't put that in a newspaper. That's exactly what he wrote. And he seemed very indignant. At this point, he's working for the CIA. But gradually, I mean, I think Switzerland
these
is kind
people
of
should be shot,
these people should be shot. These people should be shot.
For leaking.
But I think sort of, I think Switzerland, I think being in Europe for the first time as a young man was a kind of adventure for him. And an awakening. I mean, you have him complaining about the price of Swiss hamburgers and saying,
back up a little bit, Luke. Not everybody's going to know these details. First of all, when you say that you're quoting him as a young man, you're taking that from somebody who's writing on Ars Technica, the technology website, under the handle The True Hoo-Ha. Question number one, do you know for sure that was Edward Snowden who wrote for years under that handle on Ars Technica?
My understanding is that it is Edward Snowden, and in addition to that, there are photos of a young Edward Snowden, which he posted, or the True Hoo-Ha posted when he was just shy of his 23rd birthday, and it's emphatically is Edward Snowden. There's been no attempt by him or people close to him, like Glenn Greenwald, to suggest that this is in any way kind of fake or bogus. So
he grew up in Maryland. His father was kind of a libertarian, Emersonian leaning guy.
Yeah. His father quotes Emerson. His father's very high, like Snowden himself, is a highly intelligent guy who's been very supportive of him. But from a patriotic family, essentially, who believed in the Constitution. I mean, this is the key thing. I think this is what the lodestar that guided Snowden's thinking. And just going back to Switzerland, he felt.
Describe how he got there. He dropped out of high school. Why?
Well, he had what we Brits call glandular fever. He was basically ill for about 6 months, and he missed some lessons. Then he returned to a kind of community college, but didn't have a very high opinion of his teachers, and didn't make it any further. He didn't make it to university at all.
Glandular fever, is that mononucleosis? Mono, is that what you?
Correct, that's
okay.
What it is.
Okay,
I'm so
he missed a bunch of high school and then couldn't get back in the swim. He went to community college. He got a GED. He kind of drifted around. He was a tech whiz kid, and he somehow stumbled in through a kind of side door, back door into the whole security world. Not immediately directly, right, but through the University of Maryland.
Well, that's right. And one thing I did when I was researching this book was to drive to the sort of rather nice kind of place he lived in Ellicott City near Baltimore and check out his schools. And what's kind of so striking about this is the NSA's headquarters in Fort Meade is literally 15, 20 minutes away, drive. And many of his neighbors
from where
worked
he grew
at the
up.
NSA. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of... He knew about this organization from the very beginning. And I think starting out, it seemed highly unlikely that he would ever work for it.
We talk about security, but I got the impression, was he actually a security guard at some point and went from that to software, or am I dreaming?
That seems to be, taking apart the chat logs, that seems to be what happened. But this is someone who's prodigious. It's a big leap, but this is someone who's prodigiously good at computers. So even by the standards of the NSA, was something very special.
And what took him to Switzerland in U.S. government service? What role was he playing there? For what agency?
Well, he was working in Switzerland. He was stationed at the American mission. It wasn't the embassy. It was the mission in Geneva.
That's right, Geneva. That's right.
And he was called a telecoms information systems guy. In other words, he serviced the computers and the comms for American diplomats who were based there. He made sure the air conditioning functioned, and he as far as we know, he a lot of these diplomats were kind of very smart guys, but they weren't necessarily good on computers, and so he was the guy who helped them with all that.
And was traveling around Europe, in Bosnia, in Spain, all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, he was a kind of, I say in my book, he was something of an international man of mystery. He was in Bosnia, he was in Spain. He made a couple of trips to the United Kingdom, where I am, to a kind of CIA base about 30 miles north of Oxford, and where he blogs a little bit lyrically about seeing all these English sheep dotted around green fields. So he was shifting about a bit, basically doing kind of tech support, but for powerful people and inside the CIA.
He was working formally for the CIA in that capacity, or was he a contract guy at that point?
Our understanding is that he was working formally for the CIA, but one thing we also know is that the longer he was there, the more he had disagreements with his bosses about this. I think what's quite interesting is that when his sort of CIA job came to an end, having had a conflict with one of his superiors, they wrote something quite nasty in his file, in his employment file. But he then picked up a job with Dell and moved to Japan as a contractor. And the report, the file, somehow got lost in the system. It never went with him.
So by the time he's working in Hawaii for Booz Allen Hamilton, and this is not long ago, what's he doing? And what kind of access did he have? Apparently access to everything, obviously.
Well, he was a systems administrator, which meant that he was the guy who could kind of roam through all these secret places, these restricted places, quite legitimately, looking at documents, fixing corrupted files. And so he was doing this several time zones away from Fort Meade. And I think I mean, he said himself that he was really thinking about leaking about 3 or 4 years before he actually did it. But my sense is that by the time he arrived in Hawaii, this was a kind of active plan, which I believe he shared with no one. But essentially, he was gathering this material. Writing this book, I mean, this was almost one of the most thrilling bits because he's sitting in Hawaii. He reads Glenn Greenwald's column, his writings initially in Salon and then The Guardian.
And Glenn is a very tough kind of liberal, but libertarian, very, very tough on First Amendment and privacy issues.
Yeah. And even before, I mean, mm-hmm. Glenn was pretty well known. I mean, now he's world famous. But even in 2012, he was known as someone who was a critic of what Snowden sees as the surveillance state.
Yep.
So he was a kind of logical partner for Snowden. But, you know, I flew to Rio and I talked to Glenn. And basically what happened, Snowden in December of 2012 pinged Glenn an email, a rather cryptic, enigmatic anonymous email saying, can you download some encryption software? And Glenn, who's a great guy, but someone who he's really the definition of overstretched. He has dogs jumping on his head. He's got 16 chat windows open. His phone mm-hmm. rings continuously.
Yep.
He just didn't do it. And so initially, this kind of great plan misfired.
Take us back to the motivation here. You described some of what he came up with, the kind of philosophy in his household, libertarian. He was conservative in some ways, not in others. But how have you come to understand the scale of Edward Snowden's ambition? He's a very young man when he begins this work, quite young, if you're right, that he's thinking about it some years before he eventually shows up in Hong Kong with these four laptops. Where does the scale of ambition for this leak, 3-mile-high stack of documents, really undressing the entire NSA, where do you believe that comes from?
I think it's got two sources. One is sheer intellectual self-confidence. He's a brilliant guy. I mean, very brilliant guy. And I think he felt that something was deeply wrong. And seemingly, nobody was doing anything about it. I mean, he told you and my colleague in Hong Kong that, mm-hmm. that when Obama came in, he was waiting for Obama to unravel some of these programs, which he knew were going on from the Bush years. And when this didn't happen, he decided that he would have to act. So I think it comes from him. And also, I think he concluded that the sort of oversight mechanisms in the U.S., Senate, Congress, and so on, had failed because what he heard from Congress and so on, from committees which were supposed to be scrutinizing this stuff, didn't really match up with the documents that he was secretly pulling.
But that presents him as a kind of self-driven, constitution-loving iconoclast who just came up with this on his own hook, the scale of this. Here's his voice. This is from the second video released from The Guardian's Hong Kong interview with Edward Snowden. Just to hear him a bit as we discuss him. Luke Harding is with us. His new book is The Snowden Files. Here's Edward Snowden.
America is a fundamentally good country. We have good people with good values who want to do the right thing. But the structures of power that exist are working to their own ends to extend their capability at the expense of the freedom of all publics.
Edward Snowden there after he got to Hong Kong, and you imagine him thinking this whole thing up on his own. I mean, maybe he did. It's just kind of breathtaking in its ambition, the scale of it, Luke.
I'm just not persuaded that this was, as some have suggested, this was a kind of Russian plot dating back years or that some other foreign intelligence agency was involved. I mean, the clip you've just played, I think, is fascinating because essentially Snowden is a patriot. He's a patriot. And he strongly believes that what he did was patriotic. And actually,
he's saying America's a fundamentally good country, he's saying, values.
Yeah, yeah.
But gone astray here.
Gone astray. And he sees himself not as someone who seeks to blow up the NSA or blow up national security, but reform it. And he concluded, you know, his critics say that he's narcissistic, arrogant, and so on. But I wouldn't frame it like that. And my colleague Ewan, who spent many hours with him, says that actually he's a very nice guy, a very diffident guy, a very shy guy who never sought celebrity or global fame, but an idealist, if you like, an old-fashioned idealist who felt that it was beholden upon him to do something.
By no means modest in his ambitions. We're talking with Luke Harding. His new book is The Snowden Files, talking about Edward Snowden. Let's go to our callers. Jim in Canton, Ohio. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I like to propose that there could be a third option. Rather than being a traitor or a whistleblower, maybe Snowden's mission is to be a double agent, a false defector, so to speak, kind of like Oswald was in the 1950s, where you come in and pretend that you're opposed to your own government, but maybe his real mission is to put a Stuxnet virus on the Russian computers, something along those lines.
You've got him way on down the line. You mean even messing with the Russians while he's there. Jim, hey, well, look at that. I mean, it can sound out there, but Luke, listen here. This is from Face the Nation, big CBS Sunday show. This was January 19th. And here's Congressman Mike Rogers, Intelligence Committee Chair, Republican from Michigan, saying that, well, in his view, it goes this far, that Russia may have helped Snowden steal NSA information. Here's Mike Rogers.
He's likely to have had help. I think there are some interesting questions we have to answer that certainly would lend one to believe that the Russians had, at least in some part, something to do with either helping his capabilities. We noticed that a guy that was worried about privacy issues spent a lot of time, and as a recent DIA report revealed, stealing information, the vast majority of which had nothing to do with the NSA program and everything to do with our military capabilities.
Okay, there, Mike Rogers, chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Luke, two pieces there. First, he's likely to have had help, Rogers says, from Russia. Do you see a window in which that could have happened, a way? And secondly, what about his assertion that what Snowden scooped up was overwhelmingly not about the NSA, but about U.S. military capabilities?
Yeah, well, there's quite a lot to unpick here. Mm-hmm. There were intelligence officials who were speaking to the New York Times over the weekend who were saying that the kind of Mike Rogers thesis is wrong, that they found no evidence that this was a sort of Russian Kremlin plot, dating back years. And I think I'm speaking as someone who's no fan of Vladimir Putin and the Russian regime. In fact, I was kicked out of the country as a reporter in 2011. But
yes.
I'm just not persuaded by this this idea, which doesn't mean that the Russians weren't very glad to see him when he arrived in Moscow, knowing the Russian playbook and knowing how the FSB, the spy agency, operates, I think if he were a spy, they would want to keep him in place. They wouldn't want him to run away. So I don't get it. The idea that he's an American double agent in Moscow infecting.
Stuxnetting Putin's computers.
Stuxnetting Putin's regime. I mean, part of me thinks, bring it on. But the other...
the kicked out of Russia part.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the first question Vladimir Putin will have asked his spy agencies when Snowden flew into Moscow airport is this a classic American disinformation exercise? Can we believe this guy is who he says he is? Not least because Putin is not an idealist. He doesn't really understand why anybody would throw their life away for a principled cause. He's someone who believes in power and money and money and power, and he wants a big maximal Russia that's feared and respected above all by the United States.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Edward Snowden, the man who laid bare the scale of NSA surveillance. A new biography lays out his life and motivations. Luke Harding wrote it. He's a correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, where Snowden went with his earliest revelations. The book is The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. Luke Harding joins us from London. Terry's calling from Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Tom, for the call and the program.
You're welcome.
Edward Snowden is the product of a situation that hired 85,000 Edward Snowdens that were cleared by several thousand Edward Snowdens that was pushed by the Bush administration.
Well, what is an Edward Snowden, Terry? What do you mean when you say an Edward Snowden?
All these contractors were cleared by other contractors,
yep.
Not by the FBI.
Too easy to be in there, you're saying.
Well, it's just a product of what the Bush administration pushed for. They wanted this much intelligence gathering, and they bypassed a lot of the safeguards. And you got to remember that even the FBI cleared John Walker.
Terry, I appreciate your call. I mean, maybe, Luke, what are you thinking when you hear that? At that volume, when you build up a security state that big, as the United States did rush to build it up after 9/11, and we remember all the fervor around that. Is it possible to keep track of who's in there with all this access?
I think Terry makes a very good point, Tom. And the thing is, we've been here before. I was part of the Guardian team that sifted through all of the classified and secret diplomatic cables from the U.S. State Department leaked by then Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, in 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. So there'd already been one vast, vast leak from the kind of heart of kind of U.S. secrecy.
To WikiLeaks,
like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
To WikiLeaks, but then subsequently published by a yep. whole series of newspapers, including us and the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So you can't say there was no warning of this. And I do think it is extraordinary that so many people had access to this information. And it has to be said, not just NSA material, but also GCHQ material from the British spy agency. I mean, they are hopping mad that the British secrets, obviously the two agencies work very closely together, could have been scraped by, as Terry says, an NSA contractor, not a full-time employee, sitting on an island in the Pacific.
Your GCHQ actually came into The Guardian and crushed the computers and hard drives there. You described them on a big sort of bash-it-up exercise in your basement.
Yeah. I mean, I call it, Tom, I call it half Stasi, which is the East German secret police, and half pantomime, because that's precisely how it was. Essentially, the British government initially was absolutely dumbfounded by these leaks in the early kind of days. It didn't know really what to do. And then essentially what happened was over the summer of last year, we got officials, emissaries from the British Prime Minister David Cameron, who told us very bluntly, "You've had your fun. Now it's time to give the stuff back." And we essentially said, "Well, we're not going to do that." And they said, "Well, if you don't do that, we will injunct you. In other words, we'll take out a legal order, freeze your reporting, and so on." And so these bizarre interactions culminated with three of my colleagues taking the Snowden computers to an underground car park in the Guardian building in London, and watched by two spies from the British agency GCHQ, they smashed these computers up like something from the Stone Age. And I tell you, it was hot, sweaty work. It's actually quite hard to
pantomime, because these weren't the only copies of this information.
Well, we'd made this completely clear. Alan Rusbridger, the Guardian's editor, had told the British government that this was an entirely pointless exercise, because the Guardian was partnering with the Times in New York. The material was there. We also partnered with ProPublica, so they had some of this stuff. And so it was merely symbolism. But the British government wasn't in listening mode. I think they just panicked. And the crazy thing is that after we smashed our laptops up, we thought they would then turn to the Times and say, "Okay,
same
give us
for
this
you.
Stuff back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Same for you, mate. You know, we're going to bash you up." But of course, you know, firstly, you can't, because of the First Amendment.
Which you don't have in the United Kingdom, and
which
we
don't
do.
Have, and we desperately need. And I have to say, we are desperately envious of your First Amendment. I mean, I don't know if you can loan it to us, but we could really do with it.
I think you have to get that one for yourself. Good luck to you. Alex, Sharon, Vermont. Alex, you're on the air with Luke Harding. Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much for taking my call. Yeah. It seems to me that there is this whole discussion of Snowden's background and his motivation is a distraction from the fact that the head of the NSA lied to Congress. Snowden disclosed facts of violations of U.S. law passed in 2003 against this program. And what's come out today is that a person who was a drone operator is now telling us that the NSA has shared information to be able to target people, including U.S. citizens, for assassination. So that's what we need to be talking about, not about Edward Snowden and his motivation or what's going to happen to him. Because clearly what should happen to him is that he should be heralded as a hero, and the people who are engaging in violations of U.S. law, including people who lie to Congress, should be in jail.
Alex, fair enough. I mean, we have had that conversation numerous times here on the issues, on the merits. Our point here today is to understand this, the man behind the ambition of these leaks. But I take your point to the bigger picture, and many share it. Let me get one more right here. Jamie in Franklin, Tennessee. Jamie, you're on the air.
Hi there. I guess I've been kind of mildly obsessed with this Edward Snowden saga, but I keep hearing him referenced as a genius or brilliant, and I'm wondering what merits that. I'm not saying that he wasn't somewhat capable at his job, but he was on the Ars Technica asking technical questions, how to do this or that.
Well, he was an 18-year-old kid, so he might have questions, but let me understand where you're coming from, Jamie. You just are questioning his brilliance, or what about what he actually did, which Alex was just speaking to? Do you agree with Alex that this was an important, heroic act for the First Amendment or not?
Well, I'm sympathetic to concerns about First Amendment abuses, but no, I don't think he was a hero at all.
Because?
I don't think he was. Well, I don't think he carefully considered what he was willing to obtain and provide to journalists and others.
Well, he obtained and provided a lot. Jamie, I appreciate your call as well. I mean, there's a couple of perspectives right there, Luke, on the man and what he did. What about the issue of whether or not he's a genius or brilliant? Over the weekend, the Times reporting, he used pretty simple spider scraping software to do what he did. On the other hand, he plotted out the course of his action and his kind of after action pretty carefully, as you report it.
Well, I think he is clever. I think there's really no doubt about that. But your next question, Tom, is was it his cleverness or was it the NSA's incompetence that allowed him to kind of do this? And I think probably the answer is a bit of both. And so far as I understand it, there's still not a definitive account of how he did this. But we do know he was doing it over a long period of time, certainly when he arrived in Hawaii in March 2012 and up until his last few months last year with Booz Allen Hamilton. And no one spotted this. Either internally, externally, so he got away with it. He got away with it, absolutely.
Well, you and others still have access to this material. Our caller Jamie says he wasn't careful about it. I mean, I guess part of his
I don't
goal,
agree with that.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, look at Snowden's options. I mean, he could have, for example, he could have shared this material with WikiLeaks, and I think WikiLeaks would almost certainly have dumped everything out because they have a kind of philosophy of absolute disclosure.
Full exposure.
Yeah, he could have put it all on the internet.
I mean, and you're saying, as opposed internet, to journalists who will use discretion in revealing,
as opposed to hand picking a couple of kind of well-regarded senior responsible journalists who would evaluate this material. I mean, Glenn Greenwald for sure, but also Barton Gellman, who's a very distinguished correspondent, and publish stuff that was essentially in the public interest, and that's what he did. It was quite a mature strategy in a way. And he said himself in Hong Kong, I mean, he said in this Guardian interview that had he wanted to blow up the CIA, blow up the NSA, he could have published the names and addresses of field agents. Well, he didn't do that.
Luke Harding is author of The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, joins us from London. We're interested in how Americans are absorbing all this and the kind of judgments they're making about what the NSA did, about what Edward Snowden did. Luke, stand by. Carol Doherty joins us right now from Washington, Director of Political Research at the Pew Research Center. They've been polling on American perceptions of Edward Snowden and the NSA programs he helped uncover. Carol Doherty, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
How are Americans' opinions trending on Edward Snowden?
Well, they're divided over whether his actions were in the public interest. 45% say his leak served the public interest. 43% say it did not. But interestingly, most people say the government should pursue a criminal case against him, 56%. So you see some differences there about views of his actions versus whether he should be prosecuted.
Is that number, that put him on trial number, changing over time, Carol?
Not that much. I mean, there's a little bit more support for prosecuting him. I think what's interesting here, and we've made this point before, is how this cuts in a very different way than most Washington stories or most Washington issues right now. I was looking over our data. You have 57% of young people who say that Snowden's actions serve the public interest. The other group that stands out on that viewpoint is Tea Party Republicans. So on this one, you have Tea Party Republicans and young people on the same side. That's not typically the case.
Yeah. What about on the NSA and perceptions of the NSA itself? I don't know if most people were even paying attention before Edward Snowden came out, but have Americans' attitudes toward the NSA and its surveillance activities changed?
They have. They've gotten more negative over time. I mean, we last polled the weekend, right as President Obama was giving his speech on proposed changes in the NSA. By the way, that didn't really resonate. Only 8% say they heard a lot about the proposed changes when we were in the field at that time. But you get now a majority, 53%, disapproving of the government surveillance program. When we asked last summer, you got a slight margin in favor of the program, so it's trending in a more negative direction.
Let's go to Marty in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Marty, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to posit that if the government wasn't creating the crime, then there wouldn't be any reason for him to create his crime. Snowden for president, 2016. Thank you.
Okay, Marty, we see where you fall on the spectrum of poll attitudes, but thank you for your call. Let's get one more. East Quogue, New York. Chuck, you're on the air.
I think that Edward Snowden did the country a great service by demonstrating to us that our government is willing to abuse its power. However, I have mixed emotions. You have to separate the man from the deed. To give, I guess you could almost say, aid and comfort to rivals or even enemies of our country whose abuses trump anything that our NSA is doing, shows a bit of cowardice. And I think had he stayed in America and faced the music, so to speak, similar to, say, a Gordon Liddy or an Oliver North, he probably would have gotten a slap on the wrist and he'd be a hero to all. Instead, he set himself up in a position where he's a lightning rod, where his deeds were good for the country, but most people see him as a coward and perhaps even a traitor.
Chuck, I appreciate your call. I mean, the numbers divide pretty evenly, so I don't know about the most here. But Luke Harding, do you know, did Edward Snowden consider a more conventional or within the system path to whistleblowing here? Can you picture him then having later, like Liddy or Oliver North, sat before a congressional committee and then have his own radio show, slap on the wrist and out? But did he consider that path?
It's a nice fantasy, but I don't think he did consider that path, because he essentially, when he did complain to his superiors, he got nowhere, and he decided that they were part of the problem rather than the solution. And I think more than that, there are whistleblower protection programs out there, but as a contractor, he wouldn't have been able to access them. So the idea of him giving evidence, I don't think it would have come to that. I think he would have been arrested. I think he would have been held in communicado. He would have been separated from the internet, which, as he told my colleague Ewan McCaskill in Hong Kong, would have been a great privation for him. So I think what he wanted to do was to be a whistleblower who didn't end up like Chelsea Manning. In other words, 35 years in jail. And yes, he did end up in Russia, and yes, that wasn't the best place for him, but I don't think that was part of his plan. I think it was a piece of improvisation that essentially went wrong.
Do you see the basis for some kind of deal out there? The Justice Department, just in the last few weeks, came out and signaled that it was open to a plea deal, perhaps, of some kind. What sort of deal would it possibly be?
Well, you know, the deal, I can't say, but I do think there's a paradox here, which is that Obama did stand up last month and he announced reforms. He said the NSA would no longer spy on Angela Merkel's phone, that there would be some new entity, we don't know what it is, to look after metadata, your telephone records, rather than the NSA. And it was an attempt to kind of engage with what Snowden had revealed. But what the president didn't really do, in my view, was he didn't admit that this debate was only possible because of all of the information that Snowden pumped into the system. In other words, with no Snowden, you can fairly assume that that Obama wouldn't have stood up and announced any reforms at all. So if Snowden did do a favor to the nation, then I think that strengthens the argument that he should in some way be pardoned.
Carol Doherty, Edward Snowden said in the time that he was briefly making appearances on video that his biggest fear was that Americans would learn about all this and do nothing. Yes, there have been some reforms in the president's speech. Many think there ought to be more. Does your polling indicate to you that this has become the kind of issue Americans are going to demand action on, more cleanup, Carol, or not?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think you do have some people on both sides of the aisle, in Congress and in the public, who are demanding reforms. I think what Snowden accomplished was to put the whole issue of civil liberties in the public debate. I mean, in our polling, we've been asking a question for, you know, since 9/11 practically, about whether it's more important to protect against terrorism or to protect civil liberties. The balance of opinion on that question changed after these revelations in favor of civil liberties.
That is interesting. Carol Doherty at the Pew Research Center, thank you very much for being with us today. And Luke Harding, author of The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, joining us from London. Thank you to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.